felt there was a selfishness in her that she had never mastered. Something had been held back. What it was, considering all that she had done, was hard to say. But she felt it anyway, fair judgment or not, and lay awake on her cot through half the night, tense with self-reproach. In the morning, she lay wrapped in a quilt until the smell of Cholo's coffee waked her. She had fallen into the habit of letting Cholo make the coffee, mainly because he was better at it than she was. She would lie in her quilt, watching the mists float over the Platte, until one or both of the girls tiptoed out. They always tiptoed, as if they might wake their father, though his eyes were as wide open as ever. "Ma, ain't you up?" Sally would say. "We've been up a while." "Want to gather the eggs?" Betsy asked. It was her favorite chore, but she preferred to do it with her mother. Some of the hens were irritable with Betsy and would peck her if she tried to slide an egg out from under them, whereas they would never peck Clara. "I'd rather gather you two," Clara said, pulling both girls onto the cot with her. With the sunlight flooding the wide plain and both of her girls in bed with her, it was hard to feel as bad about herself as she had felt alone in the night. "Don't you want to get up?" Sally asked. She had more of her father in her than Betsy had, and it bothered her a little to see her mother lazing in bed with the sun up. It seemed to her a little wrong. At least her father had often complained about it. "Oh, shush," Clara said. "The sun's just been up 5 minutes." She reflected that perhaps that was what she had held back. She had never become proficient at early rising, despite all the practice she'd had. She had got up dutifully and made breakfast for Bob and whatever hands happened to be there, but she was not at her best, and breakfast seldom arrived on the table in the orderly fashion that Bob expected. It was a relief to her when he went away on horse trading expeditions and she could sleep late, or just lie in bed thinking and reading the magazines she'd ordered from the East or from England. The ladies' magazines had stories and parts of novels in them, in many of which were ladies who led lives so different from hers that she felt she might as well be on another planet. She liked Thackeray's ladies better than Dickens, and George Eliot's best of all. But it was a frustration that the mail came so seldom. Sometimes she would have to wait 2 or 3 months for her Black Woods, wondering all the time what was happening to the people in the stories. Reading stories by all the women, not only George Eliot, but Mrs. Gore and Mrs. Gaskell and Charlotte Young. She sometimes had a longing to do what those women did, write stories. But those women lived in cities or towns and had many friends and relatives nearby. It discouraged her to look out the window at the empty plains and reflect that even if she had the eloquence to write and the time, she had nothing to write about. With Maud Jones dead, she seldom saw another woman and had no relatives near except her husband and her children. There was an aunt in Cincinnati, but they only exchanged letters once or twice a year. Her characters would have to be the horses and the hens, if she ever wrote, for the menfolk that came by weren't interesting enough to put in books, it seemed to her. None of them were capable of the kind of talk men managed in English novels. She longed sometimes to talk to a person who actually wrote stories and had them printed in magazines. It interested her to speculate how it was done, whether they used people they knew or just made people up. Once she had even ordered some big writing tablets, thinking she might try it anyway, even if she didn't know how. But that was in the hopeful years before her boys died. With all the work that had to be done, she never actually sat down and tried to write anything. And then the boys died and her feeling changed. Once the sight of the writing tablets had made her hopeful. But after those deaths, it ceased to matter. The tablets were just another reproach to her. Something willful she had wanted. She burned the tablets one day, trembling with anger and pain, as if the paper and not the weather had been somehow responsible for the deaths of her boys. And for a time she stopped reading the magazines. The stories in them seemed hateful to her. How could people talk that way and spend their time going to balls and parties when children died and had to be buried? But a few years passed, and Clara went back to the stories in the magazines. She loved to read aloud, and she read snatches of them to her daughters as soon as they were big enough to listen. Bob didn't particularly like it, but he tolerated it. No other woman he knew read as much as his wife, and he thought it might be the cause of certain of her vanities. The care she took with her hair, for instance, washing it every day and brushing it. To him it seemed a waste. Hair was just hair. Clara watched the wagon the girls had spotted drawing closer. She saw Cholo come riding in with two mares who were ready to foal. Cholo had seen the wagon, too, and had come to look after her. He was a cautious old man, as puzzled by Clara as he was devoted to her. It was her recklessness that disturbed him. She was respectful of dangerous horses, but seemed to have no fear at all of dangerous men. She laughed when Cholo tried to counsel her. She was not even afraid of Indians, though Cholo had showed her the scars of the arrow wounds he had suffered. Now he pinned the mares and loped over to be sure she wasn't threatened by whoever was coming in the wagon. They kept a shotgun in the saddle shed, but Clara only used it to kill snakes, and she only killed snakes because they were always stealing her eggs. At times the hens seemed to her almost more trouble than they were worth, for they had to be protected constantly from coyotes, skunks, badgers, and even hawks and eagles. "I don't see but two men, Cholo," Clara said, watching the wagon. "Two men is too many if they are bad men," Cholo said. "Bad men would have a better team," Clara said. "Find any colts?" Cholo shook his head. His hair was white. Clara had never been able to get his age out of him, but she imagined he was 75 at least, perhaps 80. At night, by the fire, with the work done, Cholo wove horsehair lariats. Clara loved to watch the way his fingers worked. When a horse died or had to be killed, Cholo always saved its mane and tail for his ropes. He could weave them of rawhide, too, and once he had made one for her of buckskin, although she didn't rope. Bob had been puzzled by the gift. Clara couldn't rope a post, he said. But Clara was not puzzled at all. She had been very pleased. It was a beautiful gift. Cholo had the finest manners. She knew he appreciated her as she appreciated him. That was the year she bought him the coat. Sometimes, reading her magazine, she would look up and see Cholo weaving a rope and imagine that if she ever did try to write a story, she would write it about him. It would be very different from any of the stories she read in the English magazines. Cholo was not much like an English gentleman, but it was his gentleness and skill with horses, in contrast to Bob's incompetence, that made her want badly to encourage him to stay with him. He talked little, which would be a problem if she put him in a story. The people in the stories she read seemed to talk a great deal. He had been stolen as a child by Comanches and had gradually worked his way north, traded from one tribe to another, until he had escaped one day during a battle. Though he was an old man and had lived among Indians and whites his whole life, he still preferred to speak Spanish. Clara knew a little from her girlhood in Texas and tried to speak it with him. At the sound of the Spanish words, his wrinkled face would light up with happiness. Clara persuaded him to teach her girls. Cholo couldn't read, but he was a good teacher anyway. He loved the girls and would take them on rides, pointing at things and giving them their Spanish names. Soon all the mares in the corral were pricking their ears and watching the approaching wagon. A big man in a coat heavier than Cholo's rode beside it on a little brown horse that looked as if it would drop if it had to carry him much further. A man with a badly scarred face rode on the wagon seat beside a woman who was heavy with child. The woman drove the team. All three looked so blank with exhaustion that even the sight of people, after what must have been a long journey, didn't excite them much. A few buffalo hides were piled in the wagon. Cholo watched the travelers carefully, but they didn't seem to pose a threat. The woman drew rein and looked down at them as if dazed. "Are we in Nebraska yet?" she asked. "Yes," Clara said. "It's near 20 miles to town. Won't you get down and rest?" "Do you know D. Boot?" the woman said. "I'm looking for him." "Si, Pistolero," Cholo said quietly. He did most of their shopping and knew practically everyone in Ogallala. Elmira heard the word, knew what it meant, but she didn't care what anybody called Dee. The fact that he was nearby was all that mattered. If Dee was near, it meant that she was safe and could soon be rid of Luke and Big Zway, and not have to ride on the jolting wagon seat all day or be scared all night that they would run into Indians at the last minute. "But get down. At least you'll want to water your stock," Clara said. "You're welcome to stay the night if you like. You can easily make town tomorrow. I'd say you could all use a rest." "What town would that be?" Luke asked, easing down from the wagon seat. He had twisted a leg several days before, running to try and get a better shot at an antelope. It was all he could do to walk. Elmira didn't want to stop, even when told that it was still over half a day to Ogallala, but Zway had already dismounted and unhitched the horses. "I wish I could get to Dee," she thought, but then decided one more day wouldn't matter. She got slowly down from the wagon seat. "Come on up to the house," Clara said. "I'll have the girls draw some water." "I guess you've come a ways." "Arkansas," Elmira said. The house didn't look very far away, but as they walked toward it, it seemed to wobble in her vision. "My goodness, that is a ways," Clara said. "I lived in Texas once." Then she turned and saw that the woman was sitting on the ground. Before Clara could reach her, she had toppled sideways and lay face up in the trail that led from the house to the barn. Clara was not too alarmed, just tired, she thought. A journey all the way from Arkansas in a wagon like that would wear anybody out. She fanned the woman's face for a while, but it did no good. Cholo had seen the woman fall and ran to her, but the big man lifted the woman as easily as if she were a child and carried her to the house. "I didn't get your name, or her name either," Clara said. The big man just looked at her silently. "Is he mute?" Clara thought. But later the man with the scarred face came to the house and said no. The big man just didn't talk much. "Name's Way," he said. "Big's Way. I'm Luke. I got my face bunged up coming. And now I hurt this darn leg. Her name's Elmira." "And she's a friend of Mr. Boot?" Clara asked. They put Elmira in bed, but she hadn't yet opened her eyes. "Don't know about that. She's married to a sheriff," Luke said. He felt uncomfortable in the house after so many days outside, and soon went out again to sit on the wagon with Zway. He happened to look up and see two young girls peering at him from an open window. He wondered where the man was, for surely the good-looking woman he had talked to couldn't be married to the old Mexican. That night she asked if they would like to come in and eat supper. Zway wouldn't. He was too shy. So the woman brought their suppers out, and they ate in the wagon. The girls were disappointed at the turn of events. They seldom had company and wanted a better look at the men. "Make 'em come in, Ma," Sally whispered. She was particularly fascinated by the one with the scarred face. "I can't just order men around," Clara said. "Anyway, you've met buffalo hunters before." "Smelled them, too. These don't smell much different from any of the others." "One of them's big," Betsy observed. "Is he the lady's husband?" "I don't think so, and don't be a busybody," Clara said. "She's worn out. Maybe tomorrow she'll feel like talking." But the girls were to hear Elmira's voice long before morning. The men sitting in the wagon heard it too, long screams that raked the prairie night for hours. Once again, Clara had reason to be glad of Cholo, who was as good with women as he was with horses. Difficult births didn't frighten him as they did most men and many women. Elmira's was difficult, too. The exhausting journey over the plains had left her too weak for the task at hand. She fainted many times during the night. Clara could do nothing about it except bathe her face with cool water from the cistern. When day came, Elmira was too weak to scream. Clara was worried. The woman had lost too much blood. "Mama, Daddy's sick. He smells bad," Sally said, peeking for a moment into the sick room. The girls had slept downstairs on pallets so as to be further away from the screams. "Just leave him be. I'll take care of him," Clara said. "But he's sick. He smells bad," Sally repeated, Her eyes were fearful. "He's alive. Life don't always smell nice," Clara said. "Go make us some breakfast and take some to those men. They must be hungry." A few minutes later, Elmira fainted again. "She's too weak," Cholo said. "Poor thing," Clara said. "I would be, too, if I came that far. That baby isn't going to wait for her to get strong." "No, it's going to kill her," Cholo said. "Well, then, save it, at least," Clara said, feeling so downcast suddenly that she left the room. She got a water bucket and walked out of the house, meaning to get some water for Bob. It was a beautiful morning, light touching the farthest edges of the plains. Clara noticed the beauty and thought it strange that she could still respond to it, tired as she was, and with two people dying in her house, perhaps three. But she loved the fine light of the prairie mornings. It had resurrected her spirits time after time through the years, when it seemed that dirt and cold and death would crush her. Just to see the light spreading like that, far on toward Wyoming, was her joy. It seemed to put energy into her, make her want to do things. And the thing she wanted most to do was plant flowers, flowers that might bloom in the light. She did plant them, ordering bulbs and seeds from the east. The light brought them up, and then the wind tore them from her. Worse than the dirt, she hated the wind. The dirt she could hold her own with, sweeping it away each morning, but the wind was endless and fierce. It renewed itself again and again, curling out of the north to take her flowers from her, petal by petal, until nothing remained but the sad stalks. Clara kept on planting away, hiding the flowers in the most protected spot she could find. The wind always found them, too, in time, but sometimes the blooms lasted a few days before the petals were blown away. It was a battle she wouldn't give up on. Every winter she read seed catalogs with the girls and described to them the flowers they would have when spring came. Coming back with a bucket from the cistern, she noticed the two dirty, silent men sitting on the wagon. She had walked past them without a thought on her way to the well. "Is it born yet?" Luke asked. "Not yet," Clara said. "She's too tired to help much." A large man followed her with his eyes, but said nothing. "You've got too much fire in that stove. You'll burn everything," Clara said, when she saw how the girls were progressing with breakfast. "Oh, Ma, we can cook," Sally said. She loved to get her mother out of the kitchen. Then she could boss her younger sister around. "Is that woman real sick?" Betsy asked. "Why does she yell so much?" "She's working at a hard task," Clara said. "You better not burn that porridge, because I want some." She carried the bucket up to the bedroom, pulled the smelly sheets out from under Bob, and washed him. Bob stared straight up, as he always did. Usually she warmed the water, but this morning she hadn't taken the time. It was cold and raised goosebumps on his legs. His big ribs seemed to stick out more every day. She had forgotten to bring fresh sheets. It was a constant problem, keeping fresh sheets. So she covered him with a blanket and walked out on her porch for a minute. She heard Elmira begin to moan again and again. She ought to go relieve Cholo, she knew, but she didn't rush. The birth might take another day. Everything took longer than it should, or else went too quick. Her son's lives had been whipped away like a breath, while her husband had lain motionless for 2 months and still wasn't dead. It was wearying, trying to adjust to all the paces life required. After she stood for a moment on the cool porch, she went down the hall, just in time to hold Elmira down and watch Cholo ease the baby boy from her bloodied loins. The baby looked dead, and Elmira looked as if she were dying. But in fact, both lived. Cholo held the little boy close to his face and blew on it, until finally the child moved and began to cry, a thin sound not much stronger than a squeak of a mouse. Elmira had passed out, but she was breathing. Clara went downstairs to heat some water and saw that the girls had taken breakfast to the two men. They were standing around while the men ate, not to be denied the novelty of conversation, even if only with two buffalo hunters, one of whom wouldn't talk. It made her want to cry, suddenly, that her children were so devoid of playmates that they would hang around two sullen men just for the excitement of company. She heated the water and let the girls be. Probably the men would go on soon, though Luke seemed to be talking to the girls happily. Maybe he was as lonesome as they were. When she went up with the hot water, Elmira was awake, her eyes wide open. She was pale, almost bloodless, no color in her cheeks at all. "It's a miracle you got here," Clara said. "If you had that baby down on the plains, I doubt either one of you would have lived." The old Mexican had wrapped the infant in a flannel robe and brought it to Elmira to see. But Elmira didn't look at it. She didn't speak, and she wouldn't look. She didn't want the baby. Maybe it'll die, she thought. Dee won't want it either. Clara saw the woman turn her eyes away. Without a word, she took the infant from Cholo and walked downstairs with it, out into the sunlight. The girls still stood by the wagon, though the men had eaten. She shielded the baby's eyes with the robe and carried it over to the group. "Oh, Ma," Betsy said. She had never seen a newborn child. "What's its name?" "The lady's too tired to worry about naming it just now," Clara said. "It's a boy, though." "It's lucky we got here, ain't it?" Luke said. "Me and Zway would have had no idea what to do." "Yes, it's lucky," Clara said. Big Zway stared at the baby silently for a time. "It's red, Luke," he said finally. "I guess it's an Indian." Clara laughed. "It's no Indian," she said. "Babies mostly are red." "Can I hold it?" Sally asked. "I held Betsy. I know how." Clara let her take the child. Cholo had come downstairs and was standing at the back porch, a cup of coffee in his hands. "Zway wants to get to town," Luke said. "Can Ellie go yet?" "Oh, no," Clara said. "She's had a bad time, and she's weak. It would kill her to travel today. She'll need to rest for about a week. Maybe you could come back for her, or else we could bring her in our little wagon when she gets well." But Zway refused to leave. Ellie had wanted to get to town, he remembered, and he was determined to wait until she could go. He sat in the shade of the wagon all day and taught the two young girls how to play mumbly peg. Clara looked out at them occasionally from the upper windows. There seemed no harm in the man. Luke, bored, had ridden off with Cholo to check the mares. When Clara took the child in to nurse, she began to see that Elmira didn't want it. She turned her wide eyes away when Clara brought it near. The infant was whimpering and hungry. "Ma'am, it's got to nurse," Clara said. Elmira made no objection when the baby was put to her breast. But the business was difficult. At first, no milk would come. Clara began to fear the baby would weaken and die before it could even be fed. Finally, it nursed a little, but the milk didn't satisfy it. An hour later, it was crying in hunger again. Thin milk, Clara thought. And no wonder, for the woman probably hadn't eaten a decent meal in months. She refused to look at the baby, even when it took her breast. Clara had to hold it and encourage it, rubbing its little lips with milk. "They say you're married to a sheriff," Clara said, thinking conversation might help. The man might be the cause of her flight, she thought. She probably didn't want him in the first place and didn't ask for this child. Elmira didn't answer. She didn't want to talk to this woman. Her breasts were so full they hurt. She didn't care that the baby took the milk. She just didn't want to look at it. She wanted to get up and make Zway take her to town, to Dee, but she knew she couldn't do it yet. Her legs were so weak she could hardly move them on the bed. She would never get downstairs unless she crawled. Clara looked at Elmira for a moment and then held her peace. It was not a great surprise for her that the woman didn't want the baby. She hadn't wanted Sally, out of fear that she would die. The woman must have her own fears. After all, she had traveled for months across the plains with two buffalo hunters. Perhaps she was fleeing a man. perhaps looking for a man, perhaps just running. There was no point in pressing questions, for the woman might not know herself why she ran. Besides, Clara remembered the immense fatigue that had seized her when Betsy was born, though the last, Betsy had been the most difficult of her births. And when it was over, she could not lift her head for 3 hours. To speak took an immense effort, and Elmira had had a harder time than she had. Best just let her rest. When her strength came back, she might not be so ill-disposed toward the child. Clara took the baby downstairs and had the girls watch him while she went outside and killed a pullet. Big Zway watched silently from the wagon as she quickly wrung the chicken's neck and plucked it and cleaned it. "It takes a mess of chicken soup to run this household these days," she said, bringing the chicken back in. They had some broth left, and she heated a little, took it to Elmira. She was startled to find Elmira on her feet, staring out the window. "Goodness, you best lay down," Clara said. "You've lost blood. We've got to build you up." Elmira obeyed passively. She allowed Clara to feed her a few spoonfuls of soup. "How far's town?" she asked. "Too far for you to walk or ride either," Clara said. "That town isn't going to run away. Can't you just rest for a day or two?" Elmira didn't answer. The old man had said Dee was a pistolero. Though she didn't care what Dee was, as long as she could find him, the news worried her. Somebody might shoot him before she arrived. He might leave. Might have already left. She couldn't stand the thought. The future had shrunk to one fact, Dee Boot. If she couldn't find him, she meant to kill herself. Clara tried several times during the day to get Elmira interested in the little boy, but with no success. Elmira allowed it to nurse, but that was not successful either. The milk was so weak that the baby would only sleep an hour and then be hungry again. The girls wanted to know why the baby cried so much. "He's hungry," Clara said. "I can milk the cow early," Sally said. "We can give him some of that milk." "We may have to," Clara said. "We'll have to boil it first. It'll be too rich for him, and the colic will probably kill him," she thought. She carried the helpless little creature herself most of the day, rocking him in her arms and whispering to him. From being red, he had gone to pale, and he was a small baby, not 5 pounds, she guessed. She herself was very tired, and as the evening drew on and the sun fell, she found herself in a very uneven temper, scolding the girls harshly for their loudness 1 minute, going out on the porch with the baby, almost in tears herself, another. "Perhaps it's best that it dies." "She doesn't want it," she thought. And then the next moment the baby's eyes would open for a second, and her heart would fill. And then she would reproach herself for her own callousness. When night fell, she went in and lit a lamp in the room where Elmira lay. Clara, seeing that her eyes were open, started to take the baby to her, but once again Elmira turned her head away. "What's your husband's name?" Clara asked. "I'm looking for Dee Boot," Elmira said. She didn't want to say July's name. The baby was whimpering, but she didn't care. It was July's, and she didn't want to have anything to do with anything of July's. Clara got the infant to nurse a little and then took it up to her own room to lie down a while. She knew it wouldn't sleep long, but she herself had to sleep, was afraid to trust it with its mother yet. At some point she heard the baby whimpering, but she was too tired to rise. In the back of her mind she knew that she had to get up and feed Bob, but the desire to sleep was too heavy. She couldn't make herself move. Then she felt a hand on her shoulder and saw Cholo kneeling by the bed. "What's the matter?" Clara asked. "They leave," Cholo said. Clara jumped up and ran into the room where Elmira had been. Sure enough, she was gone. She went to the window and could see the wagon north of the corrals. Behind her, she could hear the baby crying. "Señora, I couldn't stop them," Cholo said. "I doubt they'll stop just because you ask." "We don't need any gunfights," Clara said. "Let him go. If she lives, she might come back. Did you milk?" Cholo nodded. I wish we had a goat, Clara said. I've heard goat's milk is better for babies than cow's milk. If you see any goats next time you go to town, let's buy a couple. Then she grew a little embarrassed. Sometimes she talked to Cholo as if he were her husband and not Bob. She went downstairs, made a fire in the cook stove, and began to boil some milk. When it was boiled, she took it up and gave the baby a little, dipping a cotton rag in the milk and letting the baby suck it. It was a slow method and took patience. The child was too weak to work at it, but she knew if she didn't persist, the baby would only get weaker and die. So she kept on, dribbling milk into its mouth even when it grew too tired to suck on the rag. "I know it's slow," she whispered to it. When the baby had taken all it would, she got up to walk it. It was a nice moonlight night, and she went out on her porch for a while. The baby was asleep, tucked against her breast. You could be worse off, she thought, looking at it. Your mother had pretty good sense. She waited to have you until she got to where there were people who look after you. Then she remembered that she had not fed Bob. She took the baby down to the kitchen and heated the chicken broth. Think of the work I'd save if everything didn't have to be hot, she said to the infant, who slept on. She laid it at the foot of Bob's bed while she fed her husband, tilting his head so he could swallow. It was strange to her that he could swallow when he couldn't even close his eyes. He was a big man with a big head. Every time she fed him, her wrist ached from supporting his head. "I guess we got us a boy, Bob," she said. The doctors had told her to talk to him. They thought it might make a difference. But Clara found that the only difference was that she got depressed. The depressing aspect of it was that it reminded her too clearly of their years together, for she had liked to chatter, and Bob never talked. She had talked at him for years and got no answers. He only spoke if money was concerned. She would talk for 2 hours, and he would never utter a sentence. So far as conversation went, the marriage was no different than it had ever been. It was just easier for her to have her way about money, something that also struck her as sad. She picked the baby up and held it to her bosom. The thought was in her head that if he saw her with a child, it might make a difference. Bob might see it, think it was theirs. It might startle him into life again. It was unnatural, she knew, for a mother to leave her child a day after it was born. Of course, children were endless work. They came when you didn't want them and had needs you didn't always want to meet. Worst of all, they died no matter how much you loved them. The death of her own had frozen the hope inside her harder than the wintry ground. Her hopes had frozen hard, and she vowed to keep it that way. And yet she hadn't. The hopes thawed. She had hopes for her girls and might even come to have them for the baby at her bosom. Child of another mother. Weak as it was, and slim though its chances, she liked holding the child to her. I stole you, she thought. I got you, and I didn't even have to go through the pain. Your mother's a fool not to want you, but she's smart to realize you wouldn't have much of a chance with her and those buffalo hunters. It wasn't smartness, though, she thought. The woman just didn't care. She looked down at Bob and saw that the baby had made no difference. He lay as he had, nothing left to him but need. Suddenly, Clara felt angry that the man had been fool enough to think that he could break that mare, when both she and Cholo had warned him to leave her alone. It made her angry at herself to have lived so long with a horse trader who had no more savvy than that. Yet there he was, his eyes staring upward, as helpless as the baby. She put the child down again and fed Bob soup until her wrist got tired from holding his head. Then she lay Bob's head back on his pillow and ate the rest of the chicken soup herself.
Chapter 76
Big Zway was worried that Elmira had left the baby. When she came out to the wagon, she didn't have it. "Hitch the team and let's go," she said. And that was all she said. He did it, but he felt confused. "Ain't we gonna take the baby?" he asked shyly, just before they left. Elmira didn't answer. She had no breath to answer with. She was so tired. Walking downstairs and out to the wagon had taken all of her strength. Zwei had to lift her into the wagon at that, and she sat propped against the buffalo skins, too tired even to care about the smell. She was so tired that she felt like she wasn't there. She couldn't even tell Zwei to start. Luke had to do it. "Let's go, Zwei," he said. "She don't want the baby." Zwei started the wagon, and they were soon out of sight of the house. But he was bothered. He kept looking back at Ellie, propped against the buffalo skins, her eyes wide open. Why didn't she want her baby? It was a puzzle. He had never understood the whole business, but he knew mothers took care of babies, just as husbands took care of wives. In his eyes, he had married Ellie, and he intended to take good care of her. He felt he was her husband. They had come all that way together in the wagon. Luke had tried to marry her, too, but Zwei had soon stopped that, and Luke had been behaving a lot better since. Luke had tied his horse beside the wagon, and he rode on the wagon seat beside Zwei, who kept looking around to see if Ellie was asleep. She wasn't moving, but her eyes were still wide open. "What are you looking at?" Luke asked. "I wish she'd brought the baby," Zwei said. "I always wanted us to have one." The way he said it struck Luke as curious. It was almost as if Zwei thought the baby was his. "Why would you care? It ain't yours," Luke said, to scotch that suspicion. Even if Zwei had got up his nerve to approach Ellie, which he doubted, they hadn't been on the road long enough to make a baby. "We're married," Zwei answered. "I guess it's ours." A suspicion dawned on Luke, which was even more curious. The suspicion that Zwei didn't even understand about men and women. They had spent days around the buffalo herds when the bulls and cows were mating, and yet Zwei had evidently never connected such goings-on with humans. Luke remembered that Zwei never went with whores. He mainly just watched the wagon when the other hunters went to town. Zwei had always been considered the dumbest of the dumb, but Luke knew that none of the hunters had suspected him of being that dumb. That much dumbness was hard to believe. Luke wanted to make sure he hadn't misunderstood. "Now, wait a minute, Zwei," he said. "Why do you think that baby's yours?" Zwei was silent a long time. Luke was smiling, as he did whenever he wanted to make fun of him. It didn't ordinarily much bother him that Luke made fun of him, but he didn't want him to make fun about the baby. He didn't want Luke to talk about it. It was painful enough that she had had it and then gone off and left it. He decided not to answer. "What's the matter with you, Zwei?" Luke asked. "You and Ellie aren't really married. You ain't married to somebody just because she comes on a trip with you." Zwei began to feel very sad. It might be true, what Luke said. Yet he liked to think that he and Ellie were married.
"Well, we are," he said finally.
Luke began to laugh. He turned to Ellie, who was still sitting with her back against the skins.
"He thinks that baby's his," Luke said.
"He really thinks it's his. I guess he thinks all he had to do was look at you and make it happen."
Then Luke laughed a long time. Zwei felt sad, but he didn't say any more. Luke could always find something to laugh at him about. Elmira began to feel cold. She started to shiver and reached for the pile of blankets in the wagon, but she was too weak even to untangle the blankets.
"Help me, boys," she said. "I'm real cold."
Zwei immediately handed the reins to Luke and went back to help her cover up. It was a warm night, but Ellie was still shivering. He put the blankets on her, but she didn't stop shivering. On the wagon seat, Luke would laugh from time to time when he thought of Zwei's baby. Before they had gone 5 miles, Ellie was delirious. She huddled in the blankets, talking to herself, mostly about the man called D-Boot. Her look was so wild that Zwei became frightened. Once his hand happened to brush her, and her skin was as hot as if the sun were burning down on her.
"Luke,
She's got a fever.
I ain't a doctor, Luke said. We shouldn't have left that house.
Zwei bathed her face with water, but it was like putting water on a stove. She was so hot. Zwei didn't know what to do. A person so hot could die. He had seen much death, and very often it came with fever. He didn't understand why she had had the baby, if it was only going to make her so sick. While he was bathing her face, she sat up straight and looked at him, her eyes wide.
"Dee, is that you?" she asked. "Where have you been?"
Then she fell back against the skins. Luke drove as fast as he could, but it was still a long road. The sky was light in the east when they finally found a wagon track and pulled into Ogallala. The town was not large, just a long street of saloons and stores and a few shacks on the slope north of the Platte. One of the saloons was still open. Three cowboys were lounging around outside, getting ready to mount up and go back to work. The two who were soberest were laughing at the third because he was so drunk he was trying to mount his horse from the wrong side.
"Hell, Joe's fixin' to get on backwards," one said.
They were not much interested in the fact that a wagon had pulled up. The drunk cowboy slipped and fell in the street. The other cowboys found that hilarious, one laughing so hard that he had to go over by the saloon and vomit.
"Where's the doctor live?" Luke asked the soberest cowboy. "We got a sick woman here."
At that, the cowboys all stopped and stared. All they could see was Ellie's hair. The rest of her was covered with blankets.
"Where'd she come from?" one asked.
"Arkansas," Luke said. "Where's the doctor?"
Ellie had dropped into a fevered doze. She opened her eyes and saw the buildings. It must be the town where Dee was. She began to shove off the blankets.
"Do you know Dee Boot?" she asked the cowboys.
"I come to find Dee Boot."
The cowboys stared at her as if they hadn't heard. Her hair was long and tangled, and she was wearing a nightdress. A huge buffalo hunter sat beside her.
"Ma'am, Dee Boot's in jail," one of the cowboys said politely. "It's that building over there."
Light was just filtering into the street between the shadowed buildings.
"Where's the doctor?" Luke asked again.
"Well, I don't know if there is one," the cowboy said. "We just got here last night.
I know about Boot because they were talking about him in the saloon."
Ellie began to try and climb over the side of the wagon.
"Help me, Zwei," she said. "I want to see Dee."
She got one leg over the sideboard of the wagon and suddenly began to feel weak again. She clung to the board, trembling.
"Help me, Zwei," she said again.
Zwei lifted her out of the wagon as if she were a doll. Elmira took two steps and stopped. She knew she would fall if she tried another step, and yet Dee Boot was just across the street. Once she saw Dee, she felt she could start getting well. Zwei stood beside her, big as one of the horses the cowboys rode.
"Carry me over," she said.
Zwei felt afraid. He had never carried a woman, much less Ellie. He felt he might break her, if he wasn't careful. But she was looking at him, and he felt he had to try. He lifted her in his arms and found again that she was light as a doll. She smelled different from anything he had ever carried, too. Mostly, he had just carried skins or carcasses of game. As he was carrying her, a man came out of the jail and stepped around the corner of the building. It proved to be a deputy sheriff. His name was Leon, going out to relieve himself. He was startled to see a huge man standing there with a tiny woman in her nightgown in his arms. Nothing so surprising had happened in his whole tenure as deputy. It stopped him in his tracks.
"I want to see Dee Boot," the woman said, her voice just a whisper.
"Dee Boot," Leon said, startled. "Well, we got him all right, but I doubt he's up."
"I'm his wife," Ellie said.
That was another surprise.
"Didn't know he was even married," Leon said.
Leon was watching the buffalo hunter, who was very large, it occurred to him that the couple might have come to try and break Dee Boot out of jail.
"I'm his wife. I want to see Dee," the woman said. "Zwei don't have to come."
"Dee can probably hear you. He's right in this cell," Leon said, pointing to a small barred window on the side of the jail.
"Carry me over, Zwei,"
Elmira said, and Zwei obeyed. The window was tiny in the cell, still mostly dark, but Elmira could make out a man lying on a little bare bunk. He had his arm over his eyes, and at first she doubted it was Dee. If so, he had put on weight, which wouldn't be like Dee. He prided himself on being slim and quick.
"Dee," she said. "Dee, it's me."
Her voice was the merest whisper, and the man didn't awake. Ellie felt angry. Here she had come such a distance. She had found him, yet she couldn't make him hear.
"Say something to him, Zwei," she whispered. "Your voice is louder."
Zwei was at a loss. He had never met Dee Boot and had no idea what to say to him. The task embarrassed him a little.
"Don't know anything to say."
Fortunately, it didn't matter. The deputy had gone back in, and he woke Dee Boot himself.
"Wake up, Boot," he said. "You got visitors."
The sleeping man immediately sprang up with a wild look. Ellie saw that it was him, although he hardly looked like the dapper man she remembered. He glanced at the window fearfully, and then just stood and stared. "Who's that?" he asked.
"Why, it's your wife," Leon said.
Dee came to the window. It was just two steps. Ellie saw that he had not shaved in several days. Another surprise. Dee was particular about barbering and had always had the best barber in town come and shave him every morning. The eyes that she had remembered almost every day of the long trip, Dee's merry eyes, now just looked scared and sad.
"It's me, Dee," she said.
Dee just stared at her and at the large man holding her in his arms. Ellie realized he might have the wrong idea about Zwei, although he had never been particularly the jealous type. "It's just Zwei," she whispered. "Him and Luke brought me in the wagon." "There ain't nobody else," Dee said, coming close to the bars and trying to peer out. Ellie didn't know what was wrong. He could see it was her, and yet he hardly looked at her. He seemed scared, and his hair had little pieces of cotton ticking in it from a tear in the thin mattress he slept on. The scruffy growth of whiskers made him seem a lot older than she had remembered him.
"It's just me," Elmira whispered. She was beginning to feel scared. She felt so weak she could hardly hold her eyes open,
and she wanted more than anything to talk to Dee. She didn't want to faint before they had their talk, and yet she was afraid she might.
"I left July," she said. "I couldn't do it. All I could think about was you the whole time. I should have gone with you and not even tried it. I took a whiskey boat, and then Zwei and Luke brought me in the wagon. I had a baby, but I left it. I've been coming back to you as quick as I could, Dee."
Dee kept trying to peer around them, as if he was sure there were more people than he could see. Finally, he stopped trying and looked at her. She was hoping for the old smile, but Dee didn't have it in him to smile.
"They're gonna hang me, Ellie," he said. "That's why I jumped up. I've been expecting lynchers."
Elmira couldn't believe it. Dee had never done anything wrong, not wrong enough to make people hang him. He gambled and flirted, but those weren't hanging crimes.
"Why, Dee?" she asked.
Dee shrugged. "I killed a boy," he said. "I was just trying to scare him, and he jumped the wrong way." Ellie felt confused. She had never even heard of Dee Boot shooting a gun. He carried one, like all men did, but he never ever practiced with it that she knew. Why would he try to scare a boy?
"Was he aggravating you, or what?" she asked.
Dee shrugged again. "It was a settler's boy," he said. "Some cowman hired me to run the settlers out. Most of them will run if you shoot over their heads a time or two. This one just moved the wrong way.
We'll get you out, Elmira said. Zwe and Luke will help me.
Dee looked at the big man holding Ellie. He did look big enough to pull the little jail apart, but of course he couldn't do it while he was holding a sick woman.
I'm due to hang next Friday, but they may come and lynch me first, Dee said.
Zwe felt something wet on his arms. Ellie was so light, he didn't mind holding her. The sun was up, and they could see into the cell a little better. Zwe didn't know why he felt so wet. He shifted Ellie a little and saw to his shock that the wetness was blood.
She's bleeding.
Dee looked out and saw the blood was dripping off Ellie's nightdress.
Get her to the dock, Dee said. Leon knows where he lives.
Dee began to yell for the deputy, and soon Leon came running around the jail. Elmira didn't want to go. She wanted to stay and talk to Dee, assure him that it would be all right. They would get him out. She would never let them hang Dee Boot. She looked in at him, but she couldn't talk anymore. She couldn't say the things she wanted to say. She tried, but no words came out. Her eyes wanted to close, and no matter how hard she tried to keep them open and look at Dee, they kept trying to close. She tried to see Dee again, as Way was carrying her away, but Dee's face was lost in a patch of sunlight. The sun shone brightly against the wall of the jail, and Dee's face was lost in the light. Then, despite herself, her head fell back against Way's arm, and all she could see was the sky.
Chapter 77.
It seemed to July that he was nearly as cursed as Job when it came to catching Elmira. Despite his caution, he kept having accidents and setbacks of a kind that had never happened at home in Fort Smith. 3 days out of Dodge, the new horse he had bought, which turned out not to be well broken, fell and crippled himself trying to throw a hobble. July waited a day, hoping it wasn't as bad as he thought it was, but the next day he saw it was even worse. It hardly seemed possible to lose 2 horses on 1 trip when he had never lost a horse before in his life, but it was a fact he had to face. With that fact went another. He wasn't likely to get another horse unless he went back to Dodge. North of him there was only the plains until he came to the Platte River, a long walk. July hated to double back on himself, but he had no choice. It was as if Dodge City was some kind of magnet, letting him go and then sucking him back. He shot the second horse, just as he had shot the first one, hid his saddle, and went back. He walked grimly, trying to keep his mind off the fact that Ellie was getting farther and farther away all the time. He swam the Arkansas River when he came to it, walked into town in wet clothes, bought another horse, and then left again within an hour. The old horse trader was half drunk and eager to bargain, but July cut him short.
"You ain't getting anywhere very fast, are you, young feller?" the old man said, chuckling.
July thought it an unnecessary remark. He went right back across the river. All during the trip, he had been haunted by the memory of something that had happened in Fort Smith several years before. One of the nicest men in town, a cotton merchant, had gone to Memphis on a business trip, only to have his wife take sick while he was gone. They tried to send a telegram to notify the man, but he was on his way back and the telegram never got delivered. The man's name was John Fisher. As he rode back into Fort Smith, John Fisher saw a burying party out behind the church. Being a neighborly man, he had ridden over to see who had died, and the people had all stopped, stricken, for they were burying his wife. July had been helping to cover the coffin. He never forgot the look on John Fisher's face when he realized he was a day late. His wife had died the afternoon before his return. Though a healthy man, John Fisher only lived another year himself. If he ran into someone on the street who had seen his wife on her sickbed, he always asked, "Do you think Jane might have lived if I'd got back sooner?" Everyone told him no. You couldn't have done a thing. But John Fisher didn't believe them. July had no reason to think that Ellie was sick, but he had so much worry that he hated every delay. Fortunately, his new horse was strong, a good traveler.
July pushed him hard, taking his own rest when he felt the horse needed it. He watched the horse closely, knowing that he couldn't afford to lose him. He only had $2 left, plus some coffee, bacon, and his rifle. He hoped to kill an antelope, but could not hit one. Mostly, he lived on bacon. Near the Republican River, he had a second piece of bad luck. He had camped on a little bluff, exhausted. After hobbling the horse, he fell asleep like a stone. He didn't sleep well. In the night, he felt a stinging in his leg, but was too heavy with sleep to care. Red ants had gotten him several times. When he awoke, it was to severe pain and a right leg so swollen that he had to cut his pants open to see what was wrong. When he did, he saw fang marks just above his knee. A snake must have crawled near him in the night, and in his thrashing he had turned over and scared it. He had heard no rattle, but it might have been a young snake, or had its rattle broken off. At first he was very scared. He had been bitten in the night. The poison had had several hours in which to work. It was already too late to cut the bite and try to drain the poison. He had no medicines and could do nothing for himself. He grew light-headed and assumed that he was dying. From the bluff he could see far north across the Republican, almost to Nebraska, he supposed. It was terrible bad luck to be snake-bit almost in sight of where he needed to be. He didn't even have much water, for with the river so close he had let himself run low. There was no shade on the bluff. He covered his face with his hat and lay back against his saddle, sweating and ashamed of his own carelessness. He grew delirious, and in his delirium would have long talks with Roscoe. He could see Roscoe's face as plain as day. Roscoe didn't seem to blame him for the fact that he was dead. If he himself was soon going to be dead, too, it might not matter so much. July didn't die. His leg felt terrible, though. In the night came a rainstorm, and he could do nothing but huddle under his saddle blanket. His teeth began to chatter, and he couldn't stop them. He almost wished that he could go on and die. It was so uncomfortable. But in the morning the sun was hot. He soon dried out. He felt weak, but he didn't feel as if he were dying. Mainly he had to avoid looking at his leg. It looked so bad he didn't know what to think. If a doctor saw it, he could probably just cut it off and be done with it. When he tried to bend it even a little, a terrible pain shot through him. Yet he had to get down to the river, or else die of thirst. Even though it had just rained, he had been too sick to try and catch any of the rainwater. That afternoon he stood up, but he couldn't touch his right foot to the ground. He managed to belly over the horse and get down to the river. It was 3 days before he had the strength to go back and get the saddle. The effort of getting to the river had exhausted him so much he could barely undo a button. Early one morning he shot a large crane with his pistol, and the meat put a little strength in him. His leg had not returned to normal, but it had not fallen off either. He could put a little weight on it, but not much. 5 days after the snake bit him, July saddled up and rode across the Republican River. Since leaving Dodge, he had not seen one person. He worried about Indians. Wounded as he was, he would have been easy prey. And yet, finally, he grew so lonesome that he would have been glad to see an Indian or two. He began to wonder if there were any people at all in the North. As he neared Nebraska, the plains took on a browner look. Though he was fairly sure now he wasn't going to die, he kept having spells of light-headedness in which his vision wavered and he tended to run off at the mouth. At night he would wake and find himself in the middle of a conversation with Roscoe. It embarrassed him, though no one was around to hear. But he kept on. Streams became a little more plentiful, and he ceased to worry too much about water. Once he thought he saw riders far in the distance. But when he went toward them, they turned out to be two buffalo standing on the prairie as if they were lost. July started to shoot one, but it was more meat than he needed, and if he killed one, the other buffalo would be as alone as he was. He passed on, and that night killed a big prairie chicken with a rock. 3 days later, he saw the Platte winding between low brown slopes. He soon hit a good wagon track and followed it west. About noon, he saw a lone frame house standing a mile south of the Platte. There were corrals and a few sheds near it, a sizable horse herd grazing inside of the house. July felt like crying. It meant that he wasn't lost anymore. No one would build a frame.